With us this afternoon, our special guest, Ernie Chin. G'day, Ernie. Thanks for coming in.
How are you, Annie? Thanks for asking.
Tell us about Dave Russell, an old mate of yours.
Dave worked with us in Lands and Surveys, assistance to the surveyors, and he was one of the chainmen that used to accompany the surveyors out bush. A lot of the guys was from the Stolen Generation from Melville Island as well, and they just made going bush fun. And that's an example of what used to happen around the campfires and in the survey depots after work. And so they're really good memories.
I betcha they take you back a bit. I can just see those tin mugs, you know, the enamelled mugs, having a cup of tea.
Yeah, and with the corrugated bottles.
Yeah. Hey, listen, when was that? When were you out bush?
I started with surveys after I left school, probably in about the 1963, 64s, mm-hmm. and I worked through with them till 1972.
Alrighty.
And I trained as a surveyor with Lands and Surveys here. And I spent 6 months of the year out bush with people like Dave and the Riolis and the Longs and all the other guys that make the football here now worth watching.
So did you live in caravans or did you roll out a swag?
No, we were lucky. We got paid travelling allowance where we had to roll our own swags and make our own meals, and we got paid TA, which was probably worth more than what our wages were in those days.
So it was pretty good time.
You couldn't ask for a better life. We were getting paid to go camping and fishing, after hours, of course, but it was just a good life. You're your own boss and you work with guys who are real men.
Now, I hear that you're talking about real men. You had a few close shaves. Didn't you go for a swim and get chased by a croc or something?
No, I had one bad experience where I had to swim ashore at Mandora, about a kilometre there at night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, so I was pretty terrified, but that was just one of the many things that have scared the life out of me.
Was that when you were doing this job? Or?
No, I was living at Mandora. We did a 200-block subdivision over there many years ago and was building a resort at a place called Golden Sands.
Yeah, and how come you had to swim a mile?
Well, I didn't have a dinghy to get in, and so I was stranded out there on this big boat and I had to get home, so I had to swim in.
You're kidding. You're a wild man.
No, it was stupid, I think.
Well, look, let's go back then to the ancestors. When did the Chins first arrive here?
Well, from what I can gather or what I researched is that my grandfather came out here somewhere around about the 1880s, because there's a record of one of his sons coming through Fremantle in 1880. So we can just presume 1880 was about the date. And they came here as merchants. And a lot of the Chin families that have settled here are here now have been brought over by my grandfather in respect that they came from the same village in China. So they came over and did what we call probably apprenticeships, because their fares were paid and they were looked at. After 2 or 3 years, they were then sponsored, but they were helped to go out and start their own business. And that's most of the Chins came from a village called the Seventh Village in Guangdong. And about 3 years ago, I made the journey back and found the village. And interestingly enough, I found a committee there that was made up of Chins who had produced a book about the Chins in that area of Guangdong, and it resulted in names of 30,000 Chins that originated from there that are now in this book. And luckily, I was able to find our family tree in that. And it goes that my grandfather was the 21st generation, and it goes back to the fifth generation. But the problem is, I can't read Chinese. So I've brought the book back for the Tsunghua Society, and hopefully we're going to be able to, when the society gets around to it, produce what they've produced in the Chinese Museum and add it to this book that's produced in China.
Oh, how exciting. What did it feel like when you realised, you know, that it went back right
centuries ago? It was just amazing. And once we established who we were over there and they took us to meet one of our relations, and which we proved he was, they then took us to the original house of my grandfather, which is still there, and it wouldn't be as big as your studio here. Mm. And it's still standing, dirt floor, and my father's what was going to be my father's place was just across the road. And the guy said, this is still yours. Why don't you come back here? And my wife, Cheryl, said to me, I think, Ernie, you better get on your hands and knees and thank your grandfather for having the courage and the determination to leave this place in 1880, because it was still the village. We then went up to the mountain and found the tomb where they'd brought him back and put his bones after he died. It was just amazing, just amazing.
Ah, oh, that's extraordinary. And how were the villagers to you? Were they excited to see you?
Oh, yeah. There was one guy that I don't know how he knew, but he came on his motorbike from miles away just to see us. And he was one of the sons of my grandfather who never migrated to Australia. He stayed there, so his family is still there.
Mm.
He just visited us, and then he just took off. He just wanted to see who we were. So, but I think what happens in China now, in these villages such as ours, the old people come back to the village after they've finished their work life in the bigger cities, and they're supported by their children until the older people die. Then they come back, and it just happens. That's just what's happening now.
Mm.
And that's in places where there's still villages.
Now, your family was here and then what, left during the Second World War like so many families?
Yeah, my mother and brothers and that were evacuated, I believe, in 1942. I think they went down on the ship, the British Motorist, on its last journey down before it came back and was bombed in the harbour. I was born in Sydney in a place called Ashfield. The rest of my brothers and sisters were born here. We came back in 1947, and my earliest memories of that trip were being on a train somewhere between Sydney and Adelaide,
mm-hmm.
and then from Adelaide up to Alice Springs by train, to Larimer, excuse me, and then coming up on a semi-trailer that was made of arc mesh, masonite on the outside with push-out windows. So, you know, we weren't going fast enough to worry push-out windows, but all I remember, it was so hot. And then the depot, and I think it was called Chewett's Buses, the depot was right opposite this studio in Cavanagh Street, and they pulled up there behind the old Coolpinia Meatworks. And, you know, I was only about four then, and I remember Cavanagh Street was this huge unlined street, just a dirt with these huge gutters on them. The gutters would have been about 2 foot high. And my Uncle Geoffrey, or we call him Uncle Geoffrey, he's passed away last year, he drove us down the street in this Willys or Army Jeep. And, you know, he couldn't drive because we kangaroo hopped all the way down.
Good.
But that was Darwin as a four-year-old coming from Sydney.
Yeah, well, barriers are still there, I think, down in, you know, the old gutters, I think, in
the
parts
old gutters still down in front of the old stone building called Suwa Chin's.
Yeah.
It's still there. But that gutter used to be only on Cavanagh Street, on the western side of Cavanagh Street, where the Don Hotel is across the road. It was only just open.
Yeah, yeah. So when what did you do then? What did your family do for a living?
Well, it did basically what all the Chinese shops did. They were tailors and a milk bar and a grocery shop. And they're all the same, except they had different customers.
Yeah.
And we used to, our claim to fame in those days is we were right behind the Star Theatre, and my family used to have the crushed ice drinks where they got a piece of ice, put a nail brush on it, and they used to run it over a wooden horse, crush the ice and mix it with syrup and cordial. And so everybody used to come down at 9 o'clock at interval, have their crushed lemon or orange juice, and back to the theatre.
What was it like growing up as a kid then in Darwin?
Fantastic. Fantastic. You couldn't have asked for a better place to grow up. You know, there wasn't much to do in those days. There weren't TV or anywhere in Australia, but here at least we had the bush around us. We had freedom where we believed that there was no harm could come to us. So we had the run of the place. Obviously, the place was pretty bombed out after the war, but it was a really interesting and safe and healthy place to grow up.
Annie, we've got a couple of people online who want to reminisce with you. G'day, Jeff. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad.
Now, you reckon you know about this old bus that Ernie came into town on?
Yeah, I was just over at the Tamenmen Library a few minutes ago, and they had a display of old photos of old, you know, territory transport stuff, you know, trucks and buses and things like that. And there's actually a picture of that very same bus, the semi-trailer bus over there, Tewart's bus.
Fantastic, Jeff Casey. Yeah, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, well, g'day, Ernie. How's it going? Long time no see.
Yeah, how are you?
Oh, fitting well, eh? You can't keep a good man down.
That's the way, Jeff.
Yeah. Well,
okay, good on you, Jeff.
Okay, see ya.
Well, you'll have to check that one out then, Ernie.
No, I've got pictures of it. They used to bring all the Aboriginal kids from Bagot in there every Wednesday night to the Star Theatre in a similar bus. And it was also the school bus they used to use in what they call the Darwin Higher Primary School.
Yeah, well, we've got Ian, who also was working with you at Wagard, I think. G'day, Ian. How are you?
Good, Ernie. How are you going?
Good, thanks. Tell us the story.
Going, Ernie?
Ernie, can you hear?
Yeah, Ian. Which Ian are you?
Ian and Elaine. You, I was over there with you with Robert Ray.
Oh, yeah.
How you going, mate?
Good, mate.
Yeah, it's 28 years ago now.
Yeah, well, that's when we were catching buffalo, weren't we?
Yeah, and then we started Wagga Beach.
Yeah, we started the
job.
When
you had NAR.
Yeah, that's
Deputy
right.
Deputy Lord Mayor of Darwin.
Yeah, well, that was a long time ago, mate, 1964, 65, yeah.
Yeah. Good to hear you, mate.
I haven't seen you for a long time, Ian. You should keep in touch.
Yeah, I will. Yeah.
Okay, good on you, Ian.
Oh, no worries.
How about, this is sort of like a bit of a reunion here. You've got Ernie. G'day, Les Bell. How are you?
Good, mate. My father used to be a mechanic for Len Tewart. He used to run the bus service in Alice Springs and Darwin. And the semi-trailer bus that you're referring to was a Foden, the first Foden truck bought as a prime mover with a trailer on the back, which was a coach, and it also had an over cab section where there was about probably half a dozen seats up top there where you could see over the top of the truck.
Yeah, well, I can remember it vividly looking out the window and thinking, God almighty, it's so hot. And but just when you're talking about Alice Springs, I went to school with a guy called Joe Hansen. I often wondered what happened to him because I know they do have and he was from Alice Springs, and they do have some sort of museum there, don't they?
Yeah. Well, Len Tewart, and like I say, my father was a mechanic for him, and we were only school kids at the time. And on the holidays, when he didn't have enough passengers, we used to go on runs out to Ayers Rock and places like that for free because he just wanted a few more people in the seats.
Good on you, Les. Thanks for calling. Hey, look, stay online, won't you? I want to get your phone number.
Okay,
thank you, Les. You're really sort of getting a lot of memories happening around the place, Ernie.
Yeah, well, I've got a good memory.
Good on you. Now, so you were talking about how much fun it was growing up, but didn't you have a Chinese gang when you were a young fella?
Oh, well, when I say gangs, it was not gangs like they are today. What it was most of the Chinese kids lived in the CBD because that's where all the shops were, and we all lived above our shops. And then you had the area of Stewart Park or Perap Camp. That was mainly the half-caste kids and coloured kids because they lived in the old army sheds, those tin sheds they have. And then you had what I remember as Vesties, which was where the Darwin High School is now. And there were a lot of the old meatwork buildings there that were, to put it crudely, and I'm not being disparaging, but the poorer whites lived in those days, because then you had Larrakia, Miley Point, where all the public servants' kids lived, and they were a bit flasher than the rest. And then you had the guys that were living out at Nightcliffe, and they were all living along the Nightcliffe foreshores in those Sydney William huts, a smattering of coloured people and a smattering of the poorer whites. And then you had Reddicks and Home, which a lot of the stolen generations live. So we all had our areas of where we used to play.
Yeah.
And our area of play was this end of town where the ABC studios were, right down around Horny Brooks, which is down Francis Bay, up to the gully, which is now where the golf course is, right?
And what so did everybody sort of know what their place was, did they, their little area?
Well, in those days, you know, that's as far as you could probably get on your push bike, and you know, far from home. So that's where everybody used to operate from and have your gangs, or and then you'd meet everybody at the theatre, Star Theatre, when you went to the movies, and then you'd meet everybody at school. But that's where each sort of little group operated at.
And how did you handle each other? Was there much mixing together, or did sort of stay with your own mob a bit?
Well, in town, the Chinese kids were always businesslike, so they were always in the business of making money by selling papers, so they were always working.
Mm.
We all worked in our own shops with our parents and brothers, and in the evenings we'd be selling papers or back in the shop to work, and then we'd have our own time. The other kids out in the other areas, you know, they'd be, say, at Vestey's, they'd be playing in the old tank, because that's where, you know, the old ruins were. They were a pretty dangerous place, but it was a pretty interesting place. But mostly that was looked after by the Vestey's kids, you know. So everybody had the area which they sort of concentrated on, but there was never any problems between anybody.
And what about that stadium down near the RSL? There was a boxing rink or something.
That was just a fantastic place. That was basically the focal point of all the entertainment in town. They used to have boxing very regularly, wrestling very
regularly.
This
is near the RSL here now, yeah.
And they had a basketball court, which was, that's where the basketball used to take place. So it was really a centre of where everything happened. And I can remember as a kid that they'd have to boxing, and then they'd get all the kids up in the boxing ring there, and you'd put your blindfold on and then you'd go for it, and then the crowds would be flicking in money there for the kids to pick up after. It was just a good life.
So what were you like?
Oh, we were terrorists. Never in bed before 11 o'clock.
Oh, yeah? It sounds like a wild time. But can you know how you were talking about these different communities, you know, at Nightcliff and the Reda Dixon Place and the Vestey's, and then in town with the Chinese mob and that. In between these major sort of centres, was there a lot of bush or...?
Oh, yeah, there was. I mean, down this end of town it was bush and rubble from the war. And we used to congregate in the end of Smith Street, where the bus stop is there now, because the old ANZ Bank was there,
mm-hmm.
and that was the first NT News was printed there. So behind there, while we're waiting for our papers, we used to get their lead print. You know, they used to make the print thing out of lead slate. We used to get them off, and we'd come down the back here, and we'd be throwing them at pigeons and birds, and trying to get, you know, hit one and cook it on a fire and eat it, and it was just good fun. And then you'd get your papers and on your bike, and you'd rush up to this particular building. At a later stage, became a hostel for women. And Mariner House was up the other end, so kids would have this one. So you'd come into this building here, and there'd be, I don't know, 30, 40 women here, and you'd be selling papers to them, and down in front of the Vic Hotel and in front of the Star Theatre. Yeah, it was that sort of life. Even the school teachers used to let us out early at school so we could be first in line to get our papers. So instead of 2:30, they'd let us out at, say, 2:15, and you'd see all the Chinese kids running for their bikes, to get on their bikes to race up either to the NT Standard or the NT News and put their name down first so they could be first to get their papers to go out and sell.
We're talking about your business adventures. Well, you salvaged a boat, didn't you, after the cyclone and set up a business?
No. I had a very good friend called Johnny Chatterton, to me he was the modern-day pirate, you know. He was a very adventurous man and a very likeable man. And what had happened is on Christmas Eve, we'd arranged that a group of us would go down to Black Point at Coburg Peninsula on Boxing Day, go fishing and live off the boat. So he'd taken all our dinghies and wet weather gear away on, I think his boat was the Larapan then. he'd taken that away, and away he went. We thought, okay, and the cyclone came. We thought, well, that's the end of John. He would have been caught in the cyclone. And about a week later, I'm sitting at the wreck of my house up in Duke Street. Up walks John. And I said, geez, John, I thought you were dead. He said, no. He said, we got to Black Point, heard on the radio that cyclone had been destroyed Darwin. So we steamed back to Darwin. We came across this longliner off, I think it was either Melville Island or Bathurst Island, that was, had run aground there. The crew had run the boat up on the beach and jumped off, the Japanese crew. So he rescued it. Apparently he was rescuing it, and the Catholic missions over there were stripping it. So he towed the boat off the beach to stop it from getting wrecked, parked it up the creek there with his old mate Esky, who was one of his crew, came back to town and sought my assistance in trying to claim salvage on the boat. Subsequent to that, through my solicitor, Jeff James, and John, we salvaged, we won the salvage claim and end up owning it with Sid Hawke, John Chatterton, myself, and Jeff James. And then John, being a modern-day pirate, decided that he would take Kerry Packer's group over to East Timor. The famous chapter in Packer's book, The Rise and Rise of Packer, where John Chatterton takes his film crew over to East Timor. And when he came back to save himself, because he was always getting into trouble with the government by leaving without special clearances, he brought a whole lot of refugees back. So he got away with it. And then we decided, well, John, that's a bit too heavy for us. So you take the boat, let us out.
So now, what about after that? You did the surveying out the road, those wonderful days that you had out there camping and hanging out with your mate Dave Russell and all the boys around the campfire singing and stuff like that. What have you been doing as a grown-up, you know?
Well, in 72 I decided there was the world's bigger than Darwin, so I took off and I travelled over Europe and England, came back in 73, started a real estate agency called NAR, North Australian Realty, right opposite your studios here, and did many things. I was exporting to Timor, and then the cyclone intervened, and then I went out and we did a lot of subdivision in the rural area. We probably subdivided somewhere between 500 and 1,000 5-acre to 20-acre blocks in the rural area. I did 200 blocks over at Mandora in 85, and then I was asked to do Cullen Bay, which wasn't a very easy development, but I was chosen because I think the developers recognised that my background in development and living in Darwin and understanding what people needed here and how they had to get it and what were the way to do it. So I was able to convince them that I knew how to do it, and luckily the consultant who was looking after the Cullen Bay development recognised that I did know what I was doing and gave me the opportunity to do it, even though it was only a one-man band. And that's my greatest achievement, is getting Cullen Bay to where it has been, where it was, getting it developed in those early years when it was very, very difficult.
What do you think about what's happening in as far as planning and development goes in Darwin now? Because, you know, it's something that we all discuss. There are some camps that say we've lost a bit of our old Darwin flavour. Other people who are saying, you know, given that we've got all these climate issues, that some of the places we're building are using too much energy, it's getting a bit too crowded. What's your feeling?
Well, you know, I probably have to be careful what I say, because I'm still involved in development and that type of thing in Darwin. But as a long-time Territorian, I just believe that we understand what happens here. And a lot of the things that we can't do now is because people with different ideas have come up from a different environment, from the south, and tried to put their requirements on top of us. Now, as a long-time Territorian, I resent that. I resent the fact that I can't go out and catch more than 5 snapper. I resent the fact that there's a lot of implications put on us because of people's coming up and say, well, in Sydney, you've got 5 or 6 million people. In the Gold Coast, you've got the same. We're nothing like that. We need, I mean, if you want to look back in real estate history, when we did Cullen Bay, the dearest unit you would buy in this city was 200,000. And the number of units you sold in this city, you could, over that price, you could put on one hand. Since we developed Cullen Bay, we've developed sophistication in the designs of our building and how everything is done. Now, I believe that's good. But if we're going backwards. We seem, every time you want to do something, somebody puts something in your way. One of the things I really disagree on is we need more shade in Darwin. Not so much from trees. I believe every developer should be able to build up to his building line and put an awning over the footpath. We need shade from the rain and the sun. We don't have any problems as they have Australia-wide where they've got to watch the shadow line. But, you know, these things are designed for us by guys that come up from south. I mean, they have to live here a little while to understand that.
Before they make those sort of decisions. Ernie, you got a stack of stories. I know that. I might have to ask you to come back another day, do you think?
Well, it's up to you if you can catch me.
If I can catch you. Catch me if you can. Ernie Chin, thanks very much for coming in today.
It's a pleasure.
You've taken a lot of people down wonderful memory lane.